This is the weekly podcast from the Journal of Neurosurgery. JNSPG staff will read synopses of articles which have been published online this week. The full text versions of these articles can be found in the online and print versions of the journal.
Hello and welcome to the Journal of Neurosurgery podcast for May 21st, 2010. I'm Paul Pugh and I will be reading synopses of three clinical articles, two laboratory investigations, and a review article which were published online today by the Journal of Neurosurgery. The first clinical article is Interhemispheric Hygroma After Decompressive Craniectomy. Does it predict post-traumatic hydrocephalus? It was written by Ariel Kane and colleagues. Expansive cerebral lesions are surgically treated with decompressive craniectomy. However, recent publications state that decompressive craniectomy is an independent risk factor for developing communicating hydrocephalus. The aim of this study was to determine the incidence of post-traumatic hydrocephalus in severely head-injured patients who had undergone decompressive craniectomy and to isolate factors that could predict the development of hydrocephalus. The authors paid special attention to subdural hygromas as a sign that the CSF circulation was distorted. Hydrocephalus was found in 20 of the 73 patients. In all 20 cases, hygromas were present prior to development of hydrocephalus. Hydrocephalus developed within 6 months following decompressive craniectomy. After univariate and multivariate analyses, the presence of interhemispheric hygromas was the only independent prognostic factor for the development of post-traumatic hydrocephalus. This clinical article is titled A Prospective Study of Hearing Preservation in Untreated Vestibular Schwannomas. It was written by Michael Segru and co-authors. The authors previously reported a systematic review of the literature regarding the natural history of untreated vestibular schwannomas. This previous analysis found that the best predictor of eventual hearing loss was a tumor growth rate of more than 2.5 millimeters per year. In this study, the authors present an analysis of prospectively collected outcomes in patients from their institution with untreated vestibular schwannoma. Consistent with the previous findings, patients with a tumor growth rate exceeding 2.5 millimeters per year lost their hearing at a much faster rate than those who had slower growing tumors. Initial tumor size, age at diagnosis, and neurofibromatosis type 1 status did not affect how long it took for patients to lose serviceable hearing. Interestingly, many patients with untreated vestibular schwannoma, who were followed up for more than a decade, eventually lost their hearing, regardless of whether or not the tumor grew within the interval. This clinical article is titled The Use of Clinical and Routine Imaging Data to Differentiate Between Aneurysmal and Non-Aneurysmal Subarachnoid Hemorrhage Prior to Angiography. It was written by Stefan DuPont and colleagues. Differentiating between aneurysmal and non-aneurysmal subarachnoid hemorrhage prior to angiography, based solely on the presence of certain clinical symptoms or signs, has not previously been described. What the authors of this article found is that loss of consciousness at the onset of subarachnoid bleeding always indicates a ruptured aneurysm. Bleeding combined with the loss of consciousness holds a positive predictive value of 100% for ruptured aneurysm. Possessing this simple yet vital information may aid physicians in deciding on the appropriate workup and imaging studies needed for these patients. This laboratory investigation is titled Treatment of Traumatic Brain Injury with Thymosin Beta-4 in Rats. It was written by Yi Shan and co-authors. Thymosin Beta-4 is a polypeptide distributed ubiquitously throughout mammalian tissues, including the nervous system. This study demonstrates that thymosin Beta-4 improves neurological functional recovery in mice with experimental autoimmune encephalomyelitis. The authors induced brain injury in rats over the left parietal cortex. They initiated thymosin beta-4 treatment 24 hours after injury and later evaluated brain function by the Morris water maze and footfall tests, as well as modified neurological severity scores. This is the first study to demonstrate that delayed thymosin beta 4 treatment after brain injury significantly improves spatial learning and sensory motor functional recovery, although it does not reduce lesion volume. The improvements in spatial learning and sensory motor function may derive from the effect of thymosin beta 4 treatment on reducing hippocampal cell loss and increasing angiogenesis, neurogenesis, and oligodendrogenesis. The author's data suggests that thymosin beta 4 is a potential therapy for traumatic brain injury. They believe that further investigation is warranted into the associated underlying mechanisms, establishing optimal dosage, and identifying the therapeutic treatment window. This laboratory investigation is titled Quantification of Clival and Periclival Exposure in the LeFort-1 Transmaxillary Transpterygoid Approach, a Microanatomical Study. It was written by Nicola Bowari and co-authors. The object of this cadaveric anatomical study was to describe the transmaxillary transpterygoid approach to quantify the clival and lateral periclival exposure that it provides. The authors describe a modified LeFort-1 maxillotomy with medial and posterior antrectomy and removal of the pterygoid plates aimed at improving the lateral surgical exposure during open transmaxillary surgery for the treatment of pathological conditions of the clivus. A cadaveric microanatomical study was conducted to compare the planimetric exposures allowed by the transmaxillary transpterygoid approach and the standard LeFort-1 maxillotomy. The results of this study demonstrate that the transmaxillary transpterygoid approach improves the lateral clival exposure, allowing access to the pterygopalatine and medial infratemporal fossae and related neurovascular structures. The anatomical area exposed by the transmaxillary transpterygoid approach is approximately double that exposed using the standard LeFort-1 maxillotomy approach. The authors note that clinical experience with the proposed approach is necessary in order to define possible pitfalls and complications. This review article was written by Marios, Lucas, and co-workers. It is titled Neurointerconnections Between the Nerves of the Upper Limb, a Review with Surgical Implications. Anatomical variations of the nerves of the upper limb must be taken into account by neurosurgeons both during clinical examination and operative intervention. Trauma or entrapment of these nerves may cause functional losses, some of which may be unanticipated and thus result in misdiagnosis. The primary communications between adjacent nerves of the upper limb include connections between the musculocutaneous and median nerve, the ansa pectoralis, Martin Gruber anastomosis, Marinacci or reverse Martin Gruber connection, Richacagnu anastomosis, Ramey communicans, Berrettini branches, connections between the radial and ulnar nerves on the dorsal aspect of the hand and the nerve of Legars.
Thank you for listening. Sign up in iTunes to get all our weekly podcasts delivered straight to you. To read all the articles published by the JNSPG this week, or to visit our podcast archive, please visit us at thejns.org. You can also follow the JNS on Twitter.